one has a temperature. Minister B has reference in the meeting to Mr. B. This meeting, B was surrounded by whatever packing was in the column. And so you can measure the enthalpy of absorption and desorption in the column in the exact same thing, get the same idea in the detector. So anything which can be separated in the column can be detected in the detector. And detect anything that the system could separate. Its designations were flow sensitivity and noise, absolutely intractable with conventional pumps and even noticeable with a syringe pump. Temperature sensibility, sensitivity in its odd peak shape, almost not quite equal to the derivative, the time derivative of the concentration peak. This eliminated the flow sensitivity and noise problem of the use of a syringe pump and a unique heat flux balancing method applied within the detector's packing bed. We've got a nice patent on that. And eliminated the temperature sensitivity by building the detector head and heat exchanger into a soup furnace style vacuum insulated container. I really couldn't do much about the odd peak shape. Unfortunately, the popularity of heat absorption detectors fell drastically by the time the design was complete. We were ready to go into production, so I had to scrap the detector project before we spent any more money on it. At the same time, the 1 millimeter IV columns holding coated solid beads were replaced by 4.5 millimeter inside diameter columns holding porous 5 micrometer particles was 2 mL per minute flow rates would empty our 375 mL syringe pump in about 3 operating hours. The syringe pump turned out to be very suitable for industrial chemical operations, but we were left on the sidelines in the HPLC business with only our sample chamber UV detectors and individual integrators to offer to the mainstream HPLC market. The rest of the separation rest of our separation line was in electrophoresis and density graded fractionators, which I described earlier. And we, of course, still made fraction collectors, which were useful for prep HPLC as well as low pressure LC. During this period of time, our competitors developed strong patent positions in HPLC pumps. We made another abortive effort to enter the HPLC market in 1877-8. But during the 70s, we were selling mostly classical PHPLC liquid chromatography equipment. In 1980, a small market for micro-LC became apparent, and we developed a special syringe pump and an ultra-micro variable, ultra-micro volume variable wavelength absorbance detector for it.
I wonder if I've got any cough drops in my pocket.
Find you something out there?
Well, let's see. I got a whole mess of them on my desk, but I think I got a few in my pocket.
One miscellaneous stuff, house keys, dog biscuits.
There's one here. Found
it? Yeah. Okay, thanks. Now, let's see. Now, they are still the best of their kind, but the market is too small to be very interested. In 1982, ISCO made another try at developing mainstream HPLC instruments and systems, and this time we were somewhat more successful. It's not a big part of our business, but it is large enough to be interesting. On the financial side from 1970 to 77, short-term bank loans were used extensively for working capital to finance inventory. As a manufacturer, we found that our inventory had to be very carefully controlled. This was a particular problem for ISCO, since we made a wide variety of complex products and relatively small quantities. At that time, there were more than 70,000 different kinds of parts in inventory in the separation instruments division, and one-third as many in the environmental instrument division, and there was no way of correlating the two of them together either. And finally, all the inventory such as this is not well controlled. It consumes cash at an unbelievable rate. In 77 and 8, we installed a computerized MRP, meaning Manufacturing Resources Planning System, which integrates manufacturing process scheduling, inventory control, purchasing, and demand specification of what you want to wear products and how the products are made, and incoming orders from customers. We developed this system ourselves, and it was the first one for a small manufacturing business. Before this system, we went from production crisis to production crisis, and had plenty of angry customers because we couldn't meet delivery dates even on more established products. With the use of this system, we immediately got our inventory under better control, paid off more than $600,000 in short-term bank loans, and still had got cash left over to put in short-term investments. We did this by squeezing over $800,000 worth of inventory the first year. The second year of operation of this system, we saved another $900,000 in inventory. Before this, we had this system, we had expediters in every production department who were more or less futilely trying to keep things moving smoothly by hand methods such as red tags and buck slips and stuff like that. After we installed this system, we transferred all of the expediters into more productive jobs and didn't lay anyone off. At the same time, we greatly improved our on-time deliveries to our customers. In 1980-81, ESCO issued a total a little over $4 million in IDA bonds. Yeah, this is in addition to the ones I mentioned previously. The proceeds were used to expand the 48th and Superior building from 40,000 square feet to 100,000 square feet, and to require a remodel the facility of Westgate at Westgate Industrial Park in Lincoln for the Environmental Instrument Division. The industrial park building, as we bought it, was pretty much a high-ceiling warehouse. We spent $1.2 million remodeling it into a plant for the Environmental Instrument Division. Since the ceiling was so high, we divided it vertically into two floors, making a total of 80,000 square feet. Since then, we have increased it. Environmental Division 140,000 square feet, and it paid off all the bonds. In 1985, ESCO issued stock to the general public for the first time. The purpose of this stock option, the purpose of this was not to really to raise money for the company or to allow me or any of the other management people to cash in. It was to keep the faith with our 1964 stockholders, which kept the company from going into oblivion. And it sat on their illiquid stock for 21 years. And with that, these proceeds went to the bait. Stockholders who bailed us out in 1968 when Jacob Schaefer left. The remaining proceeds to the company were about $1.6 million, prominent long-time capital. The original stockholders wound up with an almost $1 million profit each. The remainder of ESCO's permanent capital has come from retained operating profit. Here's one you have, 1990s instrument division broadens product line. Environmental instrument division broadened its product line. We only have water samplers and open flow meters. Portable meters for water quality parameters such as pH were introduced. An online, that's to say process control, total organic carbon analyzer was introduced. We introduced this instrument for pancreas to monitor their compliance on regulation of discharge organic compounds in the sewage or waterways. And that has a good market in Europe. The instrument that is going on today also is introduced a closed pipe magnetic flow meter, which has a number of technical advantages that enable it to make a good entry into this competitive market. I mean, this is a competitive market. Just very recently, we introduced a second process instrument, which is a hydrogen sulfide process analyzer. And then look at that and try to figure out what do people need for this? Well, what they use these for largely is for monitoring the sulfide content, hydrogen sulfide content and oxygen and outfalls. Mm-hmm. And then they have to add something that will sequester it, like ferric chloride or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to add any more than that stuff that is necessary. And what's necessary isn't necessarily the amount that will remove any particular amount of hydrogen sulfide, either cover any amount of hydrogen sulfide losing a particular remainder, but rather to be able to control it for ruining the value of hydrogen sulfide in the air in equilibrium with that in the water. Mm-hmm. And this thing takes a continuous water sample, sparges it and checks for Henry's law, which is kind of a wiggly S-shaped curve and over the temperature range. And runs through an H2S gas detector. And does some more massaging of it, and the result you can use to set the amount of ferric chloride necessary to bring the stink down as opposed to bringing the hydrogen sulfide down.
Yes.
And it's the stink that people are excited about. The thing is not intended to contain. Control hydrogen sulfide in large flooded sewers where the hydrogen sulfide may corrode metal parts down there. But it's intended for open water courses where the problem is nobody can stand to live in. And we just introduced that at the water show. And we'll have to see how that comes out. But that's a pretty clever thing.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a while to figure out how to do it. And, I have a lot of library work by me to find what Henry's law really is for the 600 and so by water system. You would believe in many differences of opinion that are
in the literature.
In the literature.
Yeah. I'm a historian.
Yeah. You can't, one that, for instance, in the CRC handbook isn't even close.
Hmm.
And, besides, it's not given enough temperature points to help you. But I found one of the, some very recent scholarly work and from nitrogen derived a correction factor which can if the equipment had the math baggage, full math baggage, you use the equipment use directly, but this doesn't, so only it in the 100-point lookup table.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Out of there with a neat deal.
Yeah.
separation instrument division is introduced to several products for supercritical fluid extraction in 1990. Extraction is a process of removing either analytes or contaminants from solid material. Classical way of doing this is with organic solvents in a sock foot. EPA's increase in control over the use of conventional organic solvents, a more environmentally friendly solvent is desirable. Supercritical fluid extraction typically uses carbon dioxide at high pressure and temperature as a solvent. When temperature is above 38 degrees C and temperature is above about 1050 psi, carbon dioxide behaves neither as a gas nor a liquid, but as a supercritical fluid. Supercritical fluids have extremely low viscosity and therefore rapid diffusion into the pores in which an analyte is developed. And in spite of this low viscosity, they still have retains some of the good solvating properties of liquids. This results in the rapid removal of the analyte. Commercial carbon dioxide is produced by removal and purification from flue stack gases from fossil fuel power plants, therefore preventing carbon dioxide from the supercritical extractor to the atmosphere. Does not increase the carbon dioxide load to the atmosphere, as there is a corresponding less amount of carbon dioxide emitted by power plants. And that is always a rapid and environmentally friendly extraction process. This equipment now a proportion of our entire business, especially in analysis of fats and foods. How much fat there is in foodstuffs is a big deal. And you'd be surprised at how much fat there is in a food hill, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It's 40%. And what they want to, the fat tastes good, so they want it to be 40%, but they can't have it more than 40% because people don't want to eat too much fat when they're on their back, so it has to be right at 40%. I was deeply involved in that. Most of my time was taken up with product R&D until 1996, but still a lot of it is more than most CEOs. In September 96, Douglas Grant, former head of the Environmental Instrument Division, was elected corporate president, and I became chairman and CEO. Well, actually, those were two of my existing titles. I just gave up president, whatever that means. It doesn't mean much, but it sounds good. Don't put that. In April of 96, it became apparent that maintaining two separate operating divisions, which independently designed, manufactured, and sold two product lines out of a considerable functional similarity, was not an efficient arrangement. Management functions were duplicated. Economies and scale of purchasing were not realized. Due to fluctuations in supply and demand, time in the respective engineering, sales, and manufacturing departments were not as efficiently realized as should be. Operating from two separate buildings 5 miles apart and poor road connections between them was not efficient. And I could go on doing more details of other reasons why it was not efficient. It wasn't efficient for human reasons, for one thing. Somebody over there is almost good as a competitor, not kind of disembodied voice on the phone instead of a colleague and things like that. The decision was made to consolidate the two divisions into one operating company. It was desired to expand the plant at the 4 years in Superior, the old separation instrument division plant, and locate headquarters and operations there. The decision was made because of the Superior Street location has several times as much land and better road connections to Lincoln and the outside world. The two divisional operations, operations were consolidated from an operational standpoint in June of 66. In September of 99, they were physically consolidated into an enlarged Superior Street building. The building process stretched on for too long, and the company continued to suffer until fiscal year 2000. We now have 480 employees and annual sales of something like $57 million. That's last fiscal year. Looks like it'll be more than that this year. Very profitable. The house development work has asked Susan to write this up, but she gets question marks here. I don't know what that means. It resulted in about 160 patents assigned to ISCO, with about 100 of them with me as patentee. Going back in my personal life, I didn't have much of one from the time I got back to Lincoln in 1955 until about 1972, and I slowly recovered. First, it was difficult for me to get over the situation. Maybe this way. And second, perhaps see why it took so long. My daughter didn't want me to drive a car. He was adamant about that. And I was, they convinced me that I just shouldn't drive a car. And in retrospect, kind of spoiled my life for many years. Like to women and girlfriends and prospective spouses and so forth, but not a car is about impossible. And at that time I was still living with my parents upon whom I was psychologically dependent. Suddenly my father announced to me that he and my mother were moving out. They left me pretty much living alone. Except for the company of a very intelligent dog who doted upon me. Staying as a golden retriever nicknamed Mitz. My name is Steinmetz, of course, after Charles Steinmetz, the famous engineer and physicist. I had a vocabulary of about 200 words and could parse and obey phrases like go downstairs to the basement and get me a book. And why do you do that? And this is leave off the important work. You say, go downstairs to the basement and get me the book. And he could parse that. Now, I could make up different ones, and you know he exists. And he spent all his time giving me stuff. When I would ask for stuff, he'd try and figure out something I might want. Like, if I looked uncomfortable, he'd bring me a pillow. He was an amazing dog. We took care of each other. He took care of me and I took care of him.
You're not going to tell us he read the books, though.
No, he didn't. He couldn't read. And that was a disadvantage. If there were several books that wouldn't work, he'd take the one on the top. And I'd have to remember. I wanted the book on the top. If he could not read the titles, he would know when he couldn't read the books. Same with magazines. If I wanted a top magazine on the top of the magazine stand, I said, tell me he'll get me the magazine. If it was not the one on the top, or another thing, if it was the second one, he said, go get the magazine. Oh, good dog. That. No. Go get me the magazine. I'm going to get me the second one. That'd be really at home, when I come home from work, made myself a martini. And when I was coming out from work, he would watch me drink it. And after several weeks, he wanted one too, and indicated this to me. I could understand him as well as he could understand me. The next night I made one for him too and poisoned him with a large ash tree. He chased the owl and round and round with his nose and caught it and then lapped up the drink. And I lapped up half the drink. This became a routine. And he always says, "Only one half of a drink." Once I tried to make him drink more, and he looked me right in the eye and growled at him. Well, as a pup, he was treated for a bad infection. Normal antibiotics didn't seem to work. He was dying, and that gave him a plaque test, which was unusual for not working with animals, and found that neomycin, which is an aminoglycoside, was the thing that they had would work. Unfortunately, neomycin is nephrotoxic. And I stayed with him, but was too healthy after that. And also neomycin. At age 7, he contracted liver cancer. And this time he was accompanying me to work. In 20 minutes, I think for the first time I brought him to work, he knew which of the two women he was allowed in, even if not on a leash. And given him on a leash, I could take him anywhere where it wasn't dangerous. I wouldn't take him out of the factory. But with a lab, I'd rather take him around the offices. But off the leash, he could go to my office in the company library, which at that time was right adjacent. That was interesting. Watching him go from one of the other, had to go through the forbidden room to get from one of the other. Kind of quantum tunneling effect. He moved real fast into doorways. He died at age 7, 1975. I was desolated. 2 months later, my father's cancer was diagnosed and my mother died. My life experienced some very violent ups and downs and leveled out by the end of 1975. In April of 76, I got to know my future wife, Mary Kaler. We had met a couple of times before. She was a widow and had four daughters and 2 sons with a previous marriage. I fell in love soon and proposed marriage on August 11, 1976. 2 days later, my father phoned me to say that his cancer, formally in remission, had metastasized and had a month to live, and I only had a month to live. It moved to his brain. And they couldn't treat it because of the blood-brain barrier. We moved on our wedding date up to September 4th of 76. He came to the wedding, and this was the last time I was out socially. It was really a grand wedding, and we had a good time, and we got married in a big church, and we had must have been close to 1,000 people at the wedding and 1,000 people for reception in one of the private downtown clubs. And had all the conventional stuff like champagne fountains and smoked salmon and all this kind of stuff. He died on September 15th after he had Mary and I were working in a hospital room in Houston where he went to the MD Anderson Hospital because he thought that was probably the best cancer hospital. They couldn't do anything for him. One thing that made the wedding a great affair is that Mary's family was much more dynamic, caring and loving than I had ever experienced. I got along very well with her kids, but they were too old for me to adopt them, just barely. One of them was statutorily young enough to be adopted, but she didn't feel like she, after all this time, she wanted to be adopted. Made me feel bad, but that was the only thing around about it. And Mary and I took a 2-month honeymoon to out of the way places I'd found in Europe during earlier business trips. Most of our time was spent in Slovenia in the former Yugoslav Republic when I was part of Yugoslavia then. Absolutely charming place. My biggest event after marriage was buying in 1979 and restoring until about like mid last year, the old National Register house that was built in the Richard Sennett Romanesque style, probably is easily the best example of it in the state.
Mm-hmm. It's got a heavy redstone, Colorado redstone castle like base, and shingles that are curved in a kind of a surreal sort of way above it, and the first time I'd seen that place was one of the things that I did with all the time that I got married. I was really immersed in service, or not service organizations, but community service. Like I was walked down as the chairman of the City County Planning Commission, and I